Sasha, you okay? Very good. You're not working tonight? All night long?
I'm working tonight.
What time?
This is also a work.
Oh, okay. If you sit there, maybe someone's going to, when they come through, they won't be able to see you and be a problem. What time is your shift?
Started this morning at 7 o'clock.
And then?
I work through.
All night long?
Yes, this is also work.
Okay, but after this, what do you do?
I work with the ladies.
And then?
And then?
Work at sleeping?
Yes.
Okay, I was wondering if you were going to get some of that sleeping work. So reading from the 35th chapter of the 10th canto of the Krishna book, it is called The Gopis' Feelings of Separation. Here in that, it's called The Gopis Sing of Krishna, because the resonance of Vrindavan, as Prabhupada explains in the beginning of the Krishna book, this chapter, that they were so attached to Krishna that no matter how much they saw him, it was simply not sufficient. They wanted to associate with Krishna and enjoy his company continuously. So that's the situation of the people of Braja. They have no other desire other than to be in the association of Krishna and to serve him in that way. But they didn't think it was work ever. It was just their life. Their whole existence was focused on Krishna. Now, of course, this is, we can talk about it and we can try to imagine what it would be like to have one's entire existence focused on Krishna. But of course, cannot understand. In the Madhurya Kadambini, there is a section where Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur describes, in his description of the different levels of advancement, he's describing what it's like when someone actually comes to the point where he sees Krishna. And he describes the ecstasy that he feels, and he compares his consciousness when seeing Krishna to his consciousness prior to seeing Krishna. And that prior to seeing Krishna is called a shakti, or when one is completely attached to Krishna. And practically speaking, that soul who's completely attached to Krishna cannot live a moment without Krishna. So he's already completely developed and completely evolved in his devotion and his love for Krishna. He can't live a moment without Krishna, Krishna's association, Krishna's presence. And that consciousness of complete attachment to Krishna is born of taste. Because one can't become fully attached to something or someone until one is experiencing the sweetest of tastes born of And based on that, born of that, of experiencing the sweetest of tastes in that association, then one becomes attached. It's just completely natural for the soul to become attached to where he experiences sweetness. This is true on the material level as well. Wherever there is happiness, wherever something gives us pleasure, attachment is born. But on the material level, adhyantavantikantaya, that all the tastes that we have, that we become attached to, they have a beginning and an end. And therefore, rather than being the cause of our deepest happiness, they cause us misery. Dukkha yona evite. This explains in the Bhagavad Gita. So therefore he says that nateshu ramate buddha, that the wise person shouldn't try to attempt to get his pleasures from the material world, because the results are always, because the relationship of happiness to what we're experiencing is always flickering. The relationship of pleasure to what we is always flickering as we combine our consciousness with that which is produced of the material world. It's always flickering, it's always changing, it's always temporary. So this is the question that Sanatana Goswami asked Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He said, why is there suffering in this material world? Basically, that's what he asked. Who am I? Kiyami. Who am I, and why is suffering in this world? Why do the threefold sufferings, there's so many ways to describe the sufferings of this world, and Sanatana Goswami describes them as the threefold sufferings. Why do they afflict me? And this is basically what Krishna has explained in the Bhagavad Gita. They afflict us because we are out of our place. We're out of our realm, our natural realm. Like a fish out of water must suffer. Regardless of what else he is put in contact with, he must suffer. So, even in Buddhism, this is one of the main principles, that material existence is suffering. And it's the exact principle. It's a principle that's completely opposed to the basic principle of life as we know it today. And the propaganda of life today is that the propaganda is life is meant for enjoyment, and just enjoy, you know, go for it. Buy, consume, shop until you drop, and bigger and better and more, and it's always improving. So this principle that we can of unlimited enjoyment, or the promise of unlimited enjoyment, that is so much the foundation of contemporary civilization, is opposed, completely opposed. It's diametrically opposite, completely opposite, fully opposite to, first of all, everyone's experience, and second of all, to sanity, and also opposed to the principles of Krishna consciousness. That in Krishna consciousness we say, based on, of course, what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that our real home, our real fulfillment is on a completely different level than the physical or mental or intellectual level. It is on the level of who we are, a soul. And the beginnings of materialistic, or actually the materialistic philosophy, on which materialistic culture, society is based, doesn't acknowledge that we are anything but a material body. So therefore, to talk about something above the material body really doesn't make sense on the material level to a materialistic person. And yet, although he cannot conceive of himself, because the definition of being a materialist is that reality is just what you perceive, what you can perceive. That's reality, and there's nothing beyond that. But yet, everyone perceives that there is more to existence than that. Otherwise, who is valued in this world? Even if you're a so-called materialistic person, who's given the most value in this world? A person, who's given the most value?
Oneself,
he's saying. Okay, but I don't mean like that. But at least theoretically, who's respected most? I mean, people's themselves not respected. Huh? Which is more, who's more respected? The rich person or the philanthropist?
Someone who has accumulated wealth.
Okay. Who's more respected? The person who has accumulated wealth or the philanthropist? Who's given more respect, actually?
Someone who's accumulated wealth.
Is given more respect than a Mother Teresa and a or a person who's an Albert Schweitzer who's given up his life for the benefit of others. You know, maybe people don't want to be like Mother Teresa or Albert Schweitzer, but actually they
give it. Because a lot of people think Mother Teresa was foolish. She wasn't doing anything to help the poor.
But my point is that someone who's a philanthropist, you may not think she's
changing anything,
but someone who's giving their life for others is always given so much respect in society, they're given veneration. The people who are wealthy, what are they given? Envy, basically. No one envies the philanthropist because they don't want to be like them, maybe, but they're given respect because they can't do it. And which is given more respect? Someone who's full of justice in the deepest core of our hearts, or someone who's full of greed?
Justice.
Everyone knows that justice is so important, and kindness and compassion is so important. But why? Why do we think that justice, compassion, and kindness is so important?
Maybe I can see these things ourselves.
Okay, but it gives us an intuition that there's a higher realm, with better principles that exist in common consumable society. You know, where we talk of, you know, we think life is for enjoyment and life is for this and and heavy metal rock music and everything, but yet everyone perceives that there are higher principles than this. Justice, compassion, generosity of spirit. Even if people aren't philosophical or spiritual or religious, everyone intuitively perceives that there are higher principles in life than just be happy yourself on any level. So this indicates that people, for all their materialistic thinking, for all the selfishness and, the most important thing is to be number one and everything, that everyone perceives that there's a higher set of values. Now, there may be some argument as to what the higher set of values are, but usually the whole world is in that type of agreement. More than they are religiously, they're in agreement on that there's a higher, that compassion, truthfulness, mercy, that these are values that are most respected. So there's nothing that comes in animals that have this. They're not compassionate, and it's something specific to humans, and humans also have that respect for these higher values. So this indicates that human life, a human being, has a subtlety of consciousness that has the capacity to perceive other realms, other values that are higher than just the normal life. There's some intuition or indication that human beings have this type of a higher capacity to conceive this. So what realm then would be the highest realm? That people won't agree on. But everyone will agree, either just by this simple thinking, that there are higher principles and that there are higher realms, actually. Even though they won't agree on what they are, but everyone knows that there's something higher. So what 10th canto of the Bhagavatam describes is the perfection, conceptual and spiritual perfection, of highest realms and highest values. And that is Goloka Vrindavan. And in Goloka Vrindavan, the guiding principle is what? It's love for Krishna. There is a central person, and everyone in Goloka Vrindavan, they have full love for that highest person. And therefore, everything that they do, and that highest person, of course, is the all-attractive, he who is all-attractive. So, we were reading, and it's, of course, the eternal realm. It's a higher realm. And this is what everyone is longing for. Even when people are trying to become happy in by shopping or by consuming as much alcohol as they can or becoming as famous or powerful as they can, there is an understanding inherent in that these things, power, wealth, or becoming so beautiful and fame, or someone who's completely detached and renounced, that these things are higher qualities because they will bring the respect and the admiration and of everyone else. So Krishna is that one that possesses all those qualities to the highest degree, and his realm is the realm where those qualities are valued the most, and because he possesses them. And therefore everyone who is there is people who value fame, wealth, renunciation, beauty, oneness, knowledge and strength, power. So in this realm, in the material realm, everyone is trying to get those things for themselves. And in that realm, in the spiritual realm, it's acknowledged that Krishna has those to the highest degree, and no one is envious of Krishna because of love for God, love for Krishna. There's no envy there. That is the quality that is completely absent. And in this material world, that is one of the main dominant qualities of envy, because when we see or perceive that someone has those six qualities that we just mentioned of fame, wealth, renunciation, beauty, strength, and knowledge more than we have, rather than we envy them because we want them, because we understand that those things are the source of happiness and admiration from others. So we want them, and when we want them, what someone else has, there's such a tendency to want them not to have it, which means to push them down, which is a simple definition, distinction between jealousy and envy. When one is jealous of what another has, we just want it. But when one is envious of the other person, we don't just want it. We want them not to have it, and we want to push them down. So in the spiritual world, in Goloka Vrindavan, it is it is remarkably different from the material world because of the lack of the existence of envy. Because everyone is in agreement, not by vote, but by consciousness, by qualification, because this is a qualification for being in Goloka Vrindavan and Krishnaloka, is that Krishna is the center. And until we have that consciousness, we cannot be there. Why can't we be there? It's not like they have a sign up. You know, no one but those who love Krishna can enter there, and you know, you have to prove yourself in that way, and otherwise you just can't enter. You have to take so many examinations and passports and visas and stuff like that, and show your credentials. It's not like that. Although sometimes it does seem like that, that you have to really pass a billion tests and go through 1,000 fires. But rather it's that you don't really want to be there, a place where Krishna is the center and everyone loves him, and you can't get anyone at all to consider you to be the most exalted, remarkable person. So people don't want to be there, and that's what keeps us out of the spiritual world. We don't want to be there. As soon as we actually want to be there and acknowledge unenviously that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and he's the cynosure of everyone's eyes and he's the natural repository of love, then we are instantaneously there, in fact. So, in any case, the goings-on in Goloka Vrindavan are very mysterious, and they are remarkably like, simultaneously like and unlike the material world. They're like, just like the reflection of an object is remarkably like and unlike an object in this world, or the shadow. The shadow or the reflection is remarkably like the things of this world, but remarkably lacking substance. So the spiritual world is the substance, and the material world is the shadow or the reflection. So we read how everything in the spiritual world, the gopis, the Vraja Gopikas, were seeing everything in existence. What was the first thing that they saw, if we remember back? Then they commented on the demigoddesses in the airplanes hearing Krishna's flute, because it was centered on Krishna's flute, and how they were attracted. And then the animals, the beasts, the bulls, the cows, and the deer were attracted to the sound of Krishna's flute, and their consciousness was stunned in ecstasy by coming in contact with the sound of Krishna's flute. And then after that was the rivers, the inanimate. So now it moves on to in the absence of Krishna. So in Krishna's presence, every living entity is attracted to him in the Goloka Vrindavan. But in the absence of Krishna, what happens to them? So the gopis were constantly shedding tears. But sometimes, when they expected that Krishna was coming, they would stop crying. But when they saw that Krishna was not coming, then again they would become frustrated and begin to cry. So Krishna was everything for them, everything attractive and desirable for them. And when they thought he was there or coming, or even the anticipation that he was coming closer to them, their hearts would erupt in ecstasy. They would feel like there was some purpose to their existence. And when they thought that Krishna wasn't there, because there's one verse in the 21st chapter, Kshanvantam Phalamidam Na Param Vidama, saying that the perfection or the purpose of their eyes, this again is the gopi speaking, was to see Krishna. And without seeing Krishna, their eyes had no value. That was the mood. The perfection of their eyes was to see Krishna. So in the spiritual world, this is the mood. That the eyes are meant for one thing only, and that is to see Krishna. In the material world, the mood is the eyes are meant for something completely different. They're meant for my pleasure. And they're not meant to focus on Krishna, on the Supreme Lord. Rather, they are meant simply as a window that I can view pleasurable items. And there's always the attempt for to bring the sense objects, combine them with the eyes, the pleasing, that which is pleasing to the eyes. And this is true even in, yeah, everyone is like that. And we may have different things that please us, please our eyes, like an art connoisseur. He may love to look at beautiful paintings. And if someone has a particular type of appreciation for abstract art, they love to look at those kind of paintings, and they see so much in those paintings. But someone who hasn't cultivated that type of a vision doesn't like at all to combine his eyes with the objects, those objects, particular objects of the senses. So it depends on the consciousness, what gives us pleasure. So even amongst materialistic people or spiritual people, still the different consciousnesses that they have inspire them to look in different directions for their pleasure. So the gopis, their pleasure, the residents of Vrindavan, specifically speaking about the gopis, when they expected Krishna was coming, that they would see Krishna, and just that anticipation that they would see Krishna would fill their heart, their consciousness, with the greatest pleasure. And then when they thought that they wouldn't see Krishna, they would cry and cry. And that crying was a different type of ecstasy. It was longing to be with Krishna. So Prabhupada explains. So they didn't have any alternative. Like, if this doesn't work out, we'll do something else. It was their consciousness was completely focused, and this intense greediness to be with Krishna, and not accepting any substitutes, so to speak, is the price for actually being with Krishna. Tatra loyam abhimunam ekalam. So Prabhupada continues to explain. Krishna is the original personality of Godhead, the origin of all Vishnu forms. And the cowherd boys are all demigods. Lord Vishnu, Krishna, is always worshipped and surrounded by different demigods like Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, Indra, Chandra, and others. And when Krishna traveled through the Vrindavan forest or walked on Govardhan Hill, he was accompanied by the cowherd boys. While walking, he played his flute just to call his cows. And just by his association, the trees, plants, and other vegetation in the forest immediately became Krishna conscious. A Krishna conscious person sacrifices everything for Krishna. Although the trees and plants were not very advanced in consciousness, by the association of Krishna and his friends, they also became Krishna conscious. Then they wanted to deliver everything, whatever they had, namely their fruits, flowers, and the honey incessantly falling from their branches. They wanted to deliver everything to Krishna. When Krishna walked on the bank of the Yamuna, he was seen nicely decorated with tilak on his face. He was garlanded with different kinds of forest flowers, and his body was smeared with the pulp of sandalwood and tulsi leaves. The bumblebees became mad after the fragrance and the sweetness of the atmosphere, and being pleased by the humming sound of the bees, Krishna would play his flute, and together with the sound, and together the sounds became so sweet to hear that the aquatic birds like the cranes, the swans, and ducks were charmed. And instead of swimming or flying, they became stunned. They closed their eyes and entered a trance of meditation in worship of Krishna. So this is the 8th through 11th verse. We'll read it now from the Bhagavatam directly. Krishna moves about the forest in the company of his friends. This is what the gopis are seeing and speaking of, who vividly chant the glories of his magnificent deeds. He thus appears like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, exhibiting his inexhaustible opulences. When the cows wander onto the mountainside and Krishna calls out to them with the sound of his flute, the trees and creepers in the forest respond by coming so luxuriant with fruits and flowers that they seem to be manifesting Lord Vishnu within their hearts. As their branches bend low with the weight, the filaments on their trunks and vines stand erect out of the ecstasy of love of God, and both the trees and the creepers pour down a rain of sweet sap. So it's very interesting to compare how Prabhupada translated this. He said that to the actual Bhagavatam verse. So he said that the trees and plants were not very advanced in consciousness. So what is the meaning of that? That obviously, it's obvious that in general, trees and plants, they're not advanced in consciousness. That's the simple and obvious meaning. That their consciousness is not developed like that of human beings, or a tree and a plant, even in the evolutionary scale, they're not, obviously not considered as developed in consciousness as the mammals or even birds. So, Prabhupada continues. So they don't have very high consciousness. So what does it mean not to have high consciousness or develop consciousness? It means the consciousness is quite dull. And you don't perceive. If your consciousness is very evolved, you're very aware of everything. And if your consciousness is not evolved, you're not aware. The person whose consciousness is extremely evolved, he's much more aware than even a human being whose consciousness is not evolved. So by his association, while walking, he played his flute to call his cows. Just by his association, the trees, plants, and other vegetation in the forest immediately became Krishna conscious. So Prabhupada is saying that the consciousness immediately evolved. And what I thought was interesting was, then what happened when that consciousness became evolved? And I'll read this again. Means it came up to Krishna consciousness by association. That's another interesting point. It evolved by association, Prabhupada explained here, by association with Krishna and his friends. So that means that Krishna, or those who love Krishna, that was the cause of the evolution or advancement in consciousness for those who weren't very advanced in consciousness. So what was the result of that? So by the association of Krishna and his friends, they also became Krishna conscious. They then wanted to deliver everything, whatever they had, namely their fruits, flowers, and the honey incessantly falling from their branches. So who did they want to deliver that to? They wanted to deliver, they blossomed. the natural fruits of who they were and what they had when they became advanced in consciousness, they naturally poured out whatever their capacity was, and they wanted to deliver that to Krishna. But not just deliver it to Krishna, but it was, you know, like, okay, Krishna, here's what I can produce, and I produced, and it's yours now. No, this, because what happens when one becomes Krishna conscious is, or advances in consciousness to the highest point, one is experiencing complete love, specifically for Krishna, and therefore for everyone. And therefore, everything that, the fulfillment of who they are, like in the case of the trees, and all the flowers and fruits and the honey that was the product of their of their joy and of the, of who they are, because a tree's business is to produce fruits and flowers, and a plant's business is to produce flowers. That's the fulfillment of who they are. So as they became Krishna conscious, all their fruit and flowers, immediately they wanted to deliver them to Krishna out of the great love that sprung from their consciousness. So that's basically what Prabhupada said over here. Whatever they had, as soon as they became Krishna conscious, they wanted to deliver everything, whatever they had, namely their fruits, flowers, and honey that was incessantly falling from their branches. So this is the natural product or result of love for Krishna. There is an overflowing of the heart and a blossoming of who one actually is. Anandam Buddhi Varadhanam, or actually Sitsaptakam says, Shaya Karaiva Chandrika, that there is a blossoming of the heart, of the consciousness. And then the fruits of that blossoming, they naturally, or that person who blossoms naturally wants to offer them to Krishna. And the opposing that is when our consciousness is not blossoming in love and advancing, then we want to hold everything tighter for ourselves because of lack of feeling of satisfaction and feeling that we don't have enough. We naturally hold back and try to hold everything for ourselves. So it's quite opposite. So again, now we'll read it again in the Bhagavatam verse. When the cows wandered on the mountainside and Krishna calls out to them with the sound of his flute, the trees and creepers in the forest respond by becoming so luxuriant with fruits and flowers that they seem to be manifesting Lord Vishnu within their hearts. As their branches bend low with the weight, the filaments on their trunks and vines stand erect out of the ecstasy of love of God, and both the trees and creepers pour down a rain of sweet sap. So there's a complete blossoming due to the love for Krishna that's evoked by Krishna's flute playing and Krishna's association, as Prabhupada said here, the association with those who love Krishna. Maddened by the divine honey-like aroma of the tulsi flowers on the garland Krishna wears, swarms of bees sing loudly for him. So this is a manifestation. What's being described here is what happens to the Vrindavan forest as Krishna enters. How the forest erupts in ecstasy, basically, due to Krishna's entering. And everything is gifted to Krishna for Krishna's pleasure. Whatever that entity has, as it erupts in love for Krishna, it is spontaneously and naturally offered to Krishna, the fruit of its existence. That was the term I was looking for. The fruit of its existence, of its individual existence, erupts out, and it's offered as an offering to Krishna in love. That's what I meant to say. So we are just like that too. That as individual souls with an individual relationship with Krishna, now due to our, we could say, lack of love for Krishna, we are contracted in our consciousness. The lotus of our heart is contracted. But as we advance, as we learn to love Krishna, or when we do love the Krishna, there is a natural erupting of our individual natures, our individuality. And there's natural fruit comes from that, and that is our natural offering of love to Krishna. So men, so there's the creepers in the forests. How do they respond when their love for Krishna erupts, is with their natural fruit offering to Krishna? Now, how are the bees responding? Because there are so many living entities in the forest. So men, by the divine honey-like aroma of the tulsi flowers on the garland Krishna wears, swarms of bees loudly sing for him. So that's their offering. They have two offerings. There's honey. Bees have two offerings, naturally. Honey and their sound. So there's a chorus of bees. Of course, not... I don't know where the sound comes from a bee. Is it just by the movement of the wings?
I think so.
Yeah, that's what I think. So, and it's very, very sweet and charming. So... swarms of bees sing loudly for him, and that most beautiful of all persons thankfully acknowledges and acclaims their song by taking his flute to his lips and playing it. So he reciprocates with their singing by playing his flute. And then what happens? Because love and the spiritual world and Krishna's dealings with those who love him, they're ecstatic, but they are not static. They're always moving to different realms of reciprocation, because that's the nature of love. There's the lover and the beloved, and when the lover and the beloved combine, then the result of that is different flavors of love, and because there's different reciprocations. So Krishna reciprocates with the offering of the bees by taking his flute to his lips and playing it. And then what happens? So Krishna starts playing his flute, and the charming flute song then steals away the minds of the cranes, the swans, and the other lake-dwelling birds. And how do they react when their minds are stolen? Indeed, they approach Krishna. They close their eyes, and maintaining strict silence, they worship him by fixing their consciousness upon him in deep meditation. So the flute song enters their consciousness, and it completely absorbs their consciousness. And like Munis, as that verse in the, again in the Venu Gita, the 21st chapter, Prayo Bhutamba Vihagas Munio Venezmin, that the birds become like Munis. They don't, this is how the gopis are seeing them, because Munis, like Rishis, they sit in meditative trance in the forest. So when the gopis see the birds sitting in the trees, holding on tightly, their heads cocked slightly to the side, they go to the highest point of the trees, and they just, like Munis, they close their eyes, their consciousness completely absorbed in Krishna, and their consciousness is stunned, being absorbed, being controlled by the sound of Krishna's flute. They worship Krishna. This is their offering, by fixing their consciousness upon him in deep, the deep trance of meditation. So here's the comment of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur here. To the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, rather the purport which includes the comments of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has made several illuminating comments on these verses. He gives the analogy that just as when household of Vaishnavas hear a Sankirtan party approaching, they become ecstatic and offer obeisances. So the trees and creepers in Vrindavan became ecstatic when they heard Krishna's flute, and they bowed low with their branches and vines. The word darsaniya, tilak, in text 10, indicates not only the Lord is the most excellent to see, but also he decorated himself with attractive reddish tilak taken from the mineral-rich earth of Vrindavan forest. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti also points out that the tulsi plant, although exalted in many ways, is not normally considered an especially fragrant plant. However, early in the morning, tulsi emanates a transcendental fragrance that ordinary people cannot perceive, but that the transcendental personalities fully appreciate. The bees, who are privileged to swarm about the flower garlands worn by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, certainly appreciate this fragrance. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes from the Bhagavatam 3:15-19 to the effect that the most fragrant plants in Vaikuntha also appreciate the special qualifications of Tulsi Devi. The word Sandita Venu in text 10 indicates that Lord Krishna placed his flute firmly upon his lips, and the melody emanating from that flute is certainly the most enchanting of sounds, as the gopis describe in this chapter. Enchanting. Okay, we'll stop here. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
We talked before about that we're not allowed to go to Krishna's kingdom because we can't perceive just to love him. We have to, that everybody will love us.
That's false ego.
Yeah, it just struck me that now that I'm looking at relationship with my family, for instance, my wife and daughter, that I need this love exchange. But even when I'm going to, you know, to shops or in the streets, and I see in every relationship, even if it's for one woman that I have with someone, it's like I need this love exchange, something that is so deep rooted in me. So how is it that we can just let it go?
We can't let it go by either force or by knowing that there's something better. We can't, because knowing is insufficient. But we can give it up by the gradual blossoming of our own relationship with Krishna. Then it's completely natural to give it up, because that relationship that of is the reflection, and that relationship is the reality. So the reflection can only be given up when we perceive reality. So naturally, as we advance, we become more detached from the things of this world, because if we take the philosophy of Krishna consciousness seriously, we're longing for a relationship. Okay, but we're taking that longing and placing it basically on a material body. It's the soul, the person within the body, that we're loving. But the love is projected onto the body. Because, and then if the person that we love dies, what do? We cry. But what is it? But the body is still there. So is it the body that's the thing that we loved actually, or is it the person, the life within the body that we loved? So that example is given many times in the Bhagavatam, the story of Chitraketu, when Chitraketu's son has died. But, and the body is right there, and he's crying, and his wife is crying, and everyone in the palace is crying. And then the sage Angira Muni comes with Narada, and they say to him, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "What are you asking? Why we're crying? Just look. My boy is dead. He's lying there." So he says, "Well, if you think you, the boy is your body, is his body. If that was him, then why are you crying?" He asks the same question again. And everyone cries when the soul leaves the body, because that which we loved is gone, and it's not the body. That which was lovable was gone. Right when Govinda Dasi, when Chakra's wife, died, she was dying for a long time of her cancer, and we thought she was going to leave this world during the night, so we all stayed there with her during the night, and then she passed through the night, and she was still alive. So we were completely exhausted, myself, Bonnie Ruder, and a few others. We decided we'd go to the Melbourne Temple, back to Melbourne. We were in Geelong. Hospital was in Geelong, and then we'd come back in a few hours and rest for a bit. So we came, when we were coming back, as soon as we got to Melbourne, we got a phone call from Chakra. She left, she died. So when we got back, we immediately drove back to Geelong, to the hospital, and Chakra explained what had happened. That I was sitting there, and then she left. And he said, before, I was thinking just philosophically, oh, we're not the body, we're souls. But now I actually believe it, because I saw it happen in 1 second. That there she was, a very sick, close to death person, and then in 1 second the soul had gone, and then the body was a dead body. The person had gone, his wife had gone, she had left. So what is it that he loved? Do you see that in the hospital sometimes? Huh? Yeah. Suddenly the person is there, and suddenly the person isn't there, even though the body is there. So the relationship that we're longing for is not with the body, but we as a soul are longing for a relationship with a soul. And it's perfected when we as a soul have our relationship opened with the Supreme Soul. That's the natural fulfillment of the relationship. So until we're experiencing that and the ecstasy born of that, we can't give up the other, practically speaking. And therefore, if you take to the path of karma or jnana or yoga, it's always precarious, because you're trying to do it to give up the material world by the force of an idea. Always precarious. The idea that you're a soul. But as soon as you know that you're Krishna's and your relationship with him is awake, then to give up the lesser is not difficult, but you can't give it up for an idea. I'm not sure if that directly addresses what you said. We have the idea of this, like if we say, so I was talking about in the beginning that the Vishnavati Thakur and Madhurya Kadambi, I never actually finished that point, but it's actually this point, that even when someone is very advanced, they're thinking, Krishna is like this, Krishna is like this, Krishna's skin is effulgent, is the color of a monsoon cloud that's effulgent. So when Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is describing that what happens when he actually has Sakshat Darshan, he actually sees Krishna, that stage, and he said, previously I have thought, compared your complexion to a monsoon cloud, or your dhoti color to lightning, and now I see that those comparisons were completely hollow, they're material, and you're of a different nature. So we take a comparison, because how do you go from that to describe something that's completely spiritual when all you have is a material mind? So you have to say it's like this. You go from the known to the unknown in the description. So we know what lightning is like, so we say Krishna's dhoti is like the color of lightning, but it's like the color of lightning. So as long as our consciousness is in the material realm, that's helpful, because it's pushing us higher. But actually the experience of Krishna is completely different. And when one experiences his relationship with Krishna, which Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is describing, that it comes from the platform of a sakti or a deep attachment, where you can't live for a moment without Krishna, and you don't have him. You can't live for a moment without him, and you don't have him. And the tension between that, those two states of consciousness, where you can't live for a moment without him and you don't have him, is the churning that evokes Krishna's mercy. But right now, which causes one Krishna to come and be with one. And then the shock of that, which is the soul's natural relationship to be in relationship with Krishna, makes the material world pale. Like a shadow, it's what it is, it's a reflection. One sees it in its proper perspective. Now we hear philosophically, theoretically, conceptually, we're not our body, and we're eternal souls. Then we walk out and take all the food here to feed our body as if it's feeding us, because giving pleasure to us. Well, it doesn't give pleasure to us. So we say, I'm not my body, I'm a soul. And then when we go, as you say, you go shopping, and then you see so many, the mind is attracted to so many different bodies. Consciousness is attracted because it's theoretical. But when it's the realer it is, then the detachment naturally comes. Tushti, pushti, tuta, paya, anugasan. That just as one eats, one's hunger is satisfied, bite by bite. So similarly, as one advances in Krishna consciousness, one, the soul, the self, we are satisfied, and then naturally, tushti, pushti. Tushti means satisfaction. Pushti means nourishment. Nourishment and anugrasam, one's hunger goes away. So naturally one becomes detached from those things of the material world. It's just the most natural thing. Just like when we're eating, when we sit down to eat, we have such a great appetite because we're starving. So now we're all starving for relationship, but it's with Krishna, and we're looking in the land of reflection. So we're starving. But once we're fed, then we're satisfied and we're nourished. The soul is nourished. And then detachment from all things other than Krishna naturally occurs. natural is we don't feel like eating when we've just eaten a huge feast.
Mm.
And we feel nourished. And we feel satisfied. Tushti pushti churupaya. I don't, so it's bite by bite. So that means the progression of these things. Until what to speak of the residents of Vrindavan who are on the perfected stage of this, they're, whether they're seeing him or not seeing him, they're seeing him because their consciousness is only fully absorbed in him. So there's two forms of seeing him, one seeing him in meeting and one seeing him in separation. But us, we have the duality of being with him and not being with him. And when we're not with him, we don't care. We look for something else, and because of that, we're not with him. Because we don't care. And that's the simple, honest truth. We don't care. We care about so many things, but we don't care about our relationship with Krishna. I mean, to differing degrees according to our development of our consciousness. But here, the development of consciousness is perfected already. When we have the miseries of material existence which arise due to our lack of sustenance, spiritual sustenance, we just find a way around it instead of caring for Krishna. We find that we distract ourselves. We get intoxicated. We turn on the TV. We do this. We do that. We do, but we don't long for Krishna. We don't long for the real food that will satisfy the soul.
In this paradox, it has been said very many times, when your heart taste is developed, then the lower taste automatically falls off. That's all. So we have to develop that heart taste, the love, you know, soul, the super soul, then the rest will automatically take care of itself. You don't have to do anything. Only one thing has to be done, to develop our consciousness towards higher tastes.
And that's also where humility fits in. That's the first step in acquiring the highest taste, to understand I don't have it. I'm lacking. I'm a beggar. I'm a poor man. I'm hungry. To understand I'm actually hungry. That's the first step. Because unless we understand we're hungry, then we won't try to get something to eat. And the deeper our hunger is, the more we're going to get. So just like the poles of the magnet, it's the negative pole attracts the positive. So the feeling of true humility, not self-indulgent, neurotic, low self-esteem, but true humility of the soul longing for Krishna and feeling the absence of Krishna, that attracts the positive. Just like the positive pole of the magnet is naturally attracted to the negative. So what we try to do is imitate. And that imitation is imitation only, after all. And even Dhruva is not fooled by imitation grapes and not strawberries. So what does the Krishna being fooled by imitation? Oh, I'm the lowest or this or that, all that kind of stuff that we learn how to do. He's not fooled by that, because it's the imitation. But the true humility is the soul's natural expression of his longing for only one thing, Krishna, the Supreme Lord. And I also, just going back to that same the same topic we were talking about, because it's such a wonderful topic, actually. There's so much in it. But I was also remembered a verse from the that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu quotes to Sanatana Goswami. That's from the prayer from Rukmini's letter to Krishna. When it's extreme, like when we think, why doesn't Krishna make it easy? This is Rukmini's mood. When she says, if I cannot have you in the mood, my husband, if I have to marry this Sisupal, says, and then take this and make this and juxtapose it to the mood of, why doesn't he just make it easy? And this is Rukmini's mood. This is just one of her prayers. Yeah. Oh, lotus eyed one. Yasam vipankuja rajas naparam mahanto vanchanti umapati vatamo apahatyai yarhi ambujakshana labhaya bhavat prasadam jayam asun vata krishnan satajanma bhishyat. All lotus eyed one. Great souls like Lord Shiva hanker to bathe in the dust of your lotus feet and thereby destroy their ignorance. So the greatest souls, this is their desire. Then the next thing is, well, who am I? You know, and I'm saying, you know, Krishna, why aren't you, come on, but who am I? You know, it's this insignificant, hypocrite, basically. So, O lotus-eyed one, O Krishna, she said, this is her mood. Great souls like Lord Shiva hanker to bathe in the dust of your lotus feet and thereby destroy their ignorance. Develop their love, destroy their ignorance. If I cannot obtain your mercy, I shall simply give up my vital force, which will have become weak from the severe penances I will perform, because I don't want anything else but you and your service in this particular mood. And then, after hundreds of lifetimes of endeavor, I may obtain your mercy. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, he expands it a little bit. In order to attain you in a future life, in this life, I will practice celibacy and austerities. If after one lifetime's penances I do not attain you, then I will continue doing penances for even 10 million lifetimes. I can never give up my desire to attain you. And if you tell me that there are many contaminations in me that prevent my attaining you, then let me dispel these with the dust particles of your lotus feet, which are obtainable by performance of austerities. Great devotees like Shiva, Lord Shiva, desired to bathe in the dust of your lotus feet in order to destroy the root of their ignorance. I will also destroy all my contamination by bathing in the dust of your lotus feet, which I will obtain by austerities. If I do not attain your mercy, then I will give up my life by fasting. Krishna replies, what will you accomplish by giving up your life by fasting? Rukmini, I will give up my life time after time for hundreds of births until I attain your mercy. of course, Krishna immediately, when someone is completely attracted, when someone is actually completely attracted to him, then the reciprocation is immediate. So he immediately comes.
Level of the lowly
and this is the real thing. of an eternal associate, of course, but it's placed there to show us the process. And this was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He told us what the goal is, and then he exhibited the process of attaining it. It is completely lowly, just complete focused greed, just like a person who says, "I'm going to become a billionaire, and I'm going to become a billionaire in any way. I'm going to do it." It takes that kind of a focused mentality, that type of a greed. And if someone says, you know, and someone usually, you know, everyone, you know, I watch this with the kids, you know, they grow up, you know, when they're like 12, 13, the boys, 13, 14 years old or whatever, and you ask them what do they want to be, and they want to be professional soccer players or cricket players or baseball players or something, because it's so romantic to be a professional. They watch them on television, and they, you know, and there they are, so expert, and you know, going like this, and you know, and they're making billions of dollars or whatever. So yeah, they want to be like that. But then when they see what it takes, you know, that you have to practice day and night, you have to have your consciousness focused completely on this only, and you have to mold your entire life, your entire existence, to get that. If you want that, it's not a casual thing. You're not born, you know, some people, they're born with the natural ability, and then, but it's not the natural ability alone. Like I was reading somewhere there was someone said, there's not even spiritualist, he said that, you know, there's so many geniuses just loitering around doing nothing. You need determination. So after all, and then you ask them 2 years later, what do you want to be? And you know, they want to be, you know, work in a hardware store or something, you know, because it's so much easier, and you can, you know, you can maintain yourself, and you get your senses gratified. So this is what it takes, actually. But you can't go from here to there. You can't go from my state of consciousness where to this consciousness, just by thinking it's a good idea, good romantic idea. Because it's an evolvement of consciousness. So that comes about by very much by association. That's why we associate with the Bhagavatam. That's why we associate with devotees, that's why we chant, associate with Krishna for his holy names. And then we do our part on the level we are, and then maybe Krishna will feed us. If we do our part on the level we are. So we're not fatalistic, thinking we can't do anything, but we can't do what we can't do. But we can do what we can do. So instead of trying to do what we can't do, we should try to do what we can do in a very determined way. And hope for some mercy on us. Did that answer your question somewhere in the middle of all that? Okay. Let's stop. Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah.